I want to continue in volume 2, beginning in September the 21st, 1899. Louisa has differences with Lady Obedience. Yet who would have said it, Louisa said, in spite of the fact that the wrong is hers and that she does not give me the capacity to manifest it, Miss Obedience took offence and began to act like a cruel tyrant. And she reached such cruelty as to take the sight of my loving good away from me, my sole and only comfort. It really shows that sometimes she also behaves like a little girl when she has a whim for something. If she doesn't get it with good manners, she deafens the house with screams and with crying to the point that one is forced to content her. There are no reasons. There's no way in the middle ground to persuade her. So that's the way Lady Obedience does. Brava, she says. I would not have thought you were like this. Since she wants to get her own way, she wants me, even stammering, to write about charity. Now here's Louisa reacting badly to being asked to write about this great, great thing called charity. She feels she's not able to do it. And that's why she's reacting. And all she's got to do is step out and walk on water and let Jesus speak through her. But she's really struggling. Oh, holy God, you yourself make her a little bit more reasonable, because it really shows that one cannot go on in this way. And you, Obedience, give me back my sweet Jesus. Don't cut me to the quick anymore. I pray you not to take the sight of my highest good away from me anymore. And I promise that, even stammering, I will write as you want. I only ask you, of you, the good grace to let me recover for a few days, because my mind, too little, can no longer take being immersed in that vast ocean of divine charity, especially because in it I see my miseries and my ugliness more, and in seeing the love that God has for me, I feel I am almost going mad. Now, you see, this thing is being repeated again, and that is the more you perceive God's love for you, the more you fall in love with him. That's what she calls I'm going mad. But at the same time, you see all your own faults and miseries and failings as well, because when you're looking at God, you're looking at truth, and therefore you see the truth of yourself as well as the truth of everything else. So my mind, too little, can no longer take being immersed in that vast ocean of divine charity, especially because in it I can see my miseries and my ugliness more. And in seeing the love of God has for me, I feel I'm almost going mad. And so my weak nature feels faint and can take no more. Song of Songs 2:5. But in the meantime, I will occupy myself with writing about other things and then continue with charity. So I resume my poor communication, she says. While my mind was occupied with the things already said, I was thinking to myself, what would be the purpose of writing this if I myself did not practice what I write? This writing would certainly be my condemnation. While I was thinking of this, blessed Jesus came and told me, this writing will serve to make known the one who is speaking to you and occupies your person. In other words, it'll reveal Jesus. Will you stop thinking about yourself? And then, if it doesn't serve you, my light will serve others who will read what I make you write. Now, Louisa hasn't grasped in the little bit that I've just read that when Holy Obedience asks her to do something, that God is asking her to do it. And Jesus says here very clearly, what I make you write. And he says to her, if you don't benefit from it, others will. So write. But she has great reluctance in writing. Who can say how mortified I was, Louisa said, that others would take advantage of the graces he gives me if they read these writings and I who receive them do not. Will they not condemn me? And then at the mere thought that they may end up in the hands of others, my heart aches with pain. and with blushing for myself, 1 Corinthians 9:27. Now, remaining in greatest affliction, I kept saying, what is the purpose of my state if it's just to serve as condemnation? And my most loving Jesus coming back told me, my life was necessary for the salvation of all people. And since I could not continue it on the earth, I choose whom I please in order to continue it within them. That's Louisa. So as to continue the salvation of the peoples. In other words, Jesus continues his redemptive work through the body of Christ. And there are certain members of the body of Christ, like victim souls, who are called to this work more than the rest of us. And he said, that's the purpose of your state. But she's still having problems with writing in September 22, 1899. Louisa says, I feel a nail stuck in my heart because of the words spoken yesterday by my sweet Jesus. And he, always kind with this miserable sinner, to relieve my pains, he came. And all compassion he for me, he told me, my daughter, do not want to afflict yourself any longer. Do not want means don't put your will into it. In other words, don't go into a self-pity party. Don't put your will into it. Know that everything I make you right. Now, who is the origin of this message? It's Jesus. Who is it for? It's for his kingdom. Who is it to release? It is to release the divine will upon the earth. Know that everything I make you right, either about virtues or in the form of similes, is nothing but making you portray yourself and the perfection which I made your soul reach. And Louisa's reaction was, oh God, what a great repugnance I feel in writing these words, because what he says does not seem true to me. I feel I still don't understand what virtue and perfection is, but obedience wants it so, and it is better to croak than having to deal with her. More so, since she has two faces. If one does as she says, she assumes the appearance of a lady and caresses you like a most faithful friend. Even more, she promises you all the goods that are in heaven and on earth. But then as soon as she detects a shadow of difficulty against her, immediately without letting herself be noticed, one goes about looking at her and finds her a warrior in the act of arming his weapons to wound you and destroy you. Oh my Jesus, what kind of virtue is this obedience that makes one tremble at the mere thought of her? Notice the way she shifts from male to female images there quite easily. Then while Jesus was saying these words to me, I told him, my good Jesus, what good is it for my soul to have so many graces, if then they embitter my whole life, especially because of the hours of your privation? In fact, understanding who you are and of whom I am being deprived, it is a continuous martyrdom for me. So they serve me for nothing but to keep me continuously embittered. And Jesus said, when a person has tasted the sweetness of a food and then is forced to take the bitter, in order to remove that bitterness, he doubles his desire to taste the sweet. And this does much good to that person, because if he always tasted the sweet without ever tasting bitterness, he would not take the sweet into great consideration. In other words, you need balance in the spiritual life, just as you need balance in all life. We need night to balance the day. We need darkness to balance the light. We need morning to balance the evening, and so on and so on. But if the person always tasted bitterness without knowing what the sweet is, and by not knowing it, he would not even desire it, therefore both one and the other do good. So it's good for you also to taste both bitter and sweet. So Louisa said, my Jesus, most patient in bearing a soul so miserable and ungrateful, forgive me. It seems to me that this time I want to investigate too much. And Jesus said, do not be disturbed. You're not allowed to be disturbed. You must keep a very calm interior. It is I myself who raise these difficulties in your interior, to have the occasion to converse with you and also to instruct you in everything. This is very important. Not only does Jesus allow these problems to crop up in her, but Louisa's struggles and finding these answers from the Lord is very important instruction for us as well. And an awful lot of these instructions are more for us than for her. September the 25th, 1899. Louisa is the defender of Jesus and of people. In my mind, I was thinking, if these writings end up in somebody's hands, this person might say, she must be a good Christian if the Lord gives her so many graces, not knowing that in spite of all this, I'm still so bad. Here is how people can deceive themselves both in good and in evil. Ah, Lord, you alone know the truth and the depth of the hearts. While I was thinking of this, blessed Jesus came and told me, my beloved, and what if people knew that you are my defender and theirs? In other words, they won't get the message that you think they'll get. They'll get the real message. So Louisa said, my Jesus, what are you saying? He said, what? Is it not true that you defend me from the pains that they give to me by placing yourself between me and them? That's called standing in the breach. And you'll find it in Psalm 106, verse 23. And you'll find it also in Isaiah 58, verse 12, where the prophet laments that there's nobody to stand in the breach to keep back the justice of God from sinners. So he says, that's the position of the intercessor and the victim soul, that they would stand in the breach. So by placing yourself between me and them, and that you take upon yourself the blow that I am to receive, as well as that which I should pour down upon them, you're willing to give me a refreshment by taking justice upon yourself, and to give them a refreshment by taking justice upon yourself. And if sometimes you do not receive it upon yourself, it's because I don't allow it. And this, to your great sorrow, to the point of lamenting to me, can you perhaps deny it? He said. No, Lord, she said, I can't deny it. But I see that it is something that you yourself have infused in me. John 15:5, without me, Jesus said, you can do nothing. And this is why I say that it's not because I am good. And I feel all confused in hearing you speak these words to me, she said. So, September the 26th, 1899. Oppositions to writing. How the Most Holy Virgin is a portent of grace. Abstractive sight and intuitive sight. This morning my adorable Jesus came. He carried me outside of myself, but to my greatest sorrow, I saw him from behind. And as much as I prayed him to let me see his most holy face, it was impossible. In my interior, I kept saying, who knows whether it's because of my oppositions against the obedience to right that he doesn't deign to show his adorable face. And while saying this, I cried. After he let me cry, he turned around and he said, I take your oppositions into no account. Because your will is so identified with mine that you cannot want but what I myself want. Now, here is the first indication, and it's only volume 2, where Louisa's will is completely identified with the divine will. And this is what the Lord wants from us as well, that our wills be completely identified with his. And so he says to Louisa, in fact, at this point, you're only able to want what I want. So, though it is repugnant for you, at the same time you feel drawn to it as by a magnet. Therefore, your repugnances serve for nothing else as to render the virtue of obedience more embellished and bright. That's why I ignore them. So, Louisa says, afterwards I looked at his most beautiful face, and in my interior I felt an indescribable contentment. And turning to him, I said, my most sweet love, if I take so much delight in looking at you, what must it be for our Queen Mother when you enclosed yourself in her most pure womb? What contentments, how many graces did you not give to her? And he said, my daughter, the delights and the graces that I poured into her were so great and so many that it's enough to tell you that what I am by nature, my mother became by grace. Now, the church has known that for all of its life, for all of its history. It's John 19:27. More so, since she had no sin in her, therefore my grace was able to lord freely within her. To lord freely is to rule and to reign. And therefore my grace was able to rule freely within her. There is nothing of my being which I did not give to her. That's the most incredible statement. You see, there was literally no opposition in Blessed Mother's soul to the Lord. And so the Lord gave himself fully to her insofar as a creature could take that fullness. At that instant, Louisa said, I seemed to see our Blessed Mother as if she were another God, which you would have to put in inverted commas. Psalm 82, verse 5, I said you are gods, all of you sons of the Most High. Gods there with the small g. With this difference alone, that in God, this is his own nature, while in Mary Most Holy, it is acquired by grace. Who can say how stupefied I was left, how my mind was lost in seeing a portent of grace so prodigious? So turning to him, I said, my dear good, our mother had so much good because you let yourself be seen intuitively. I would like to know, how do you show yourself to me? Is it by abstractive or by intuitive sight? It's a very, very important question. Okay. And the answer is going to be very illuminative for us. Who knows whether it is even abstractive at all? And he said, I want to make you understand the difference that passes between one and the other. In the abstractive, the soul contemplates God, while in the intuitive, she enters into him and obtains graces. So one is you're looking at God from the outside, and the other one is you're entering into him. Which one is better? It's better to enter into him. That is, she receives within her the participation in the divine being. How many times have you not participated in my being? That suffering which seems almost natural to you, that purity by which you reach the point of feeling as if you don't even have a body, and many other things, have I not communicated this to you when I have drawn you to myself intuitively? What a marvellous, marvellous passage that is. Ah, Lord, it's so true, Louisa said. And I, what thanks have I rendered you for this? What has been my response to you? I feel blushing at the mere thought of it. Oh, please forgive me and let it be known in heaven and on earth that I am an object of your infinite mercies. And that's what he's doing through these writings. So September the 30th, 1899. This is a very important message about patience during temptation. Louisa says, earlier I spent more than 1 hour in hell. In passing, I went about looking at the image of baby Jesus, and a thought like lightning said to the baby, how ugly you are. I tried not to pay attention to it, nor to become disturbed. You see, Jesus doesn't want her to be disturbed about anything, in order to avoid some game with the devil. Yet in spite of this, that diabolical lightning penetrated into my heart, and I felt that my poor heart was hating Jesus. Ah, yes, I felt I was in hell, keeping company with the damned. I felt love changed into hate. Oh God, what pain being unable to love you. So Louisa said, Lord, it is true that I'm not worthy to love you, but at least accept this pain, that I would want to love you, but cannot. Now, there is a very important prayer. If you are unable to pray for whatever reason, that you just admit to the Lord that you can't do it, but that you would like to do it, and then ask your guardian angel to pray for you and ask your patron saints and ask Blessed Mother, and you'll be fine. So, after spending more than 1 hour in hell, Louisa said, it seemed I got out of it, thank God. But who can say how afflicted and weakened my poor heart was left because of the war fought between hate and love. I felt such prostration of strength that it seemed to me I had no more life. Then I was caught by my usual state, but oh, how worn out. My heart and all my interior powers, which with unspeakable yearning desire to go in search of their highest and only good. That's Song of Songs, chapter 3, verses 1 to 4. And when they find him, only then do they stop and enjoy him to their greatest contentment. This time, they did not even dare to move because she's exhausted. They were so annihilated, confused and sunk in their nothingness. Now, notice the sunk in their nothingness. I want you to keep noting that all the time. That they did not let themselves be heard. Oh God, what a cruel blow my heart had to suffer. In spite of all this, my always kind and loving Jesus came, and his consoling sight made me forget immediately that I had been in hell, so much so that I did not even ask Jesus' forgiveness. The interior powers, which are intellect, memory, and will, humiliated and tired as they were, seemed to rest in him. That is Psalm 62, rest in God, my soul. Everything was silence. So it's complete rest. That's what that silence is, that depth of silence. On both sides, there was nothing but a few loving glances that wounded each other's heart. After remaining in this profound silence for some time, Jesus said, my daughter, I'm hungry. Give me something. And Louisa said, I've nothing to give you. But at that very instant, I saw a loaf of bread and I gave it to him, because she's in and out of the body experience, so things are not the same as on earth. I gave it to him and he seemed to eat it with all pleasure. Now, in my interior, I kept saying, it's been a few days since he told me something. And Jesus answered my thought, because in the spirit world, you don't need to use words in order to communicate. All the communication is done by intellect. Jesus answered my thought. Sometimes, he said, the groom is pleased to deal with his bride and to entrust his most intimate secrets to her. At other times, when he delights with great pleasure in resting as they contemplate each other's beauty. Now, Song of Songs, chapters 4 and chapter 6 is the bridegroom and the bride contemplating each other with love. So in this resting, speaking impedes resting. And the mere thinking of what one has to say and of what one has to deal with diverts one's attention from looking at the beauty of the groom or of the bride. However, this is needed. In fact, after they have rested and understood each other's beauty more, they love each other more and with greater strength. And with greater strength, they enter the field again to work, to negotiate and to defend their interests. Now, for that first part, I want to give you Psalm 116, verse 7 and Matthew 11:28 for the rest. Come and rest in me. And for entering the field to work in their interests, I want to give you the Song of Songs, chapters 11 and 12. So after the bride and the bridegroom enjoy each other's company, then they go out into the field of the world to look after souls. So he said, this is what I'm doing with you. Aren't you happy? Then Louisa said, after this, a thought flashed through my mind about the hour spent in hell. And immediately I said, Lord, forgive me how many offences I've given to you. And he said, do not want to afflict or disturb yourself. It is I who leads the soul deep into the abyss to then be able to lead her more quickly to heaven. In other words, the way up is down. The way to the heights of heaven is through the annihilation of our wills, to go into our nothingness and to have to experience temptation and struggle upon the earth. Then he made me understand that that loaf of bread that I found was nothing but the patience with which I had borne that hour of bloody battle. Now, that's a very important thing for us to realise, that we don't like the struggle and we think there's something wrong if we're struggling, but the struggle is actually very important. And the Lord is telling us that in that struggle, if we're patient and if we just try to stay doing the will of God and continuously giving ourselves to God and declaring before heaven, earth and hell that we do not want to sin, we only want the will of God, then we are producing food or a loaf of bread for Jesus. Therefore, patience, humiliation and offering God what one suffers in time of temptation is nourishing bread that one gives our Lord, which he accepts with great pleasure. So that should put a different gloss on the times when we're actually struggling. October the 1st, 1899, Jesus speaks with bitterness about the abuses of the sacraments. That's over a century ago. This morning, my beloved Jesus continued to make himself seen in silence, but with the most afflicted appearance. He had a thick crown of thorns driven into his head. I felt my interior powers silent, that's the intellect, memory and will, and I didn't dare to say a single word. But in seeing that he suffered very much in his head, I stretched out my hands and very carefully removed the crown of thorns. But what a bitter spasm he suffered! How his wounds opened more and the blood poured out in torrents. In truth, it was something that tortured the soul. After I removed it, I placed it on my head, and Jesus himself helped so that it might penetrate inside, because that's the problem. The prick on the outside is nothing. It's when it penetrates the head. However, everything was silence on both parts. So here you have the two of them completely at one in wanting to carry on this relationship. But what was my surprise when after a little while I went about looking at him again and I saw that with their offences creatures were putting another crown on the head of Jesus. What human perfidy. Now that's Jeremiah, I think it's 17. I can't remember the verse at this moment, where Jeremiah says that the human heart is perverse. Oh, incomparable patience of Jesus, how great you are. And Jesus kept silent and almost did not look at them so as not to know who the offenders were. Look at the charity and the kindness there. Again, Louisa said, I removed the crown, and as all my interior powers woke up with tender compassion, all my interior powers, intellect, memory and will, woke up with tender compassion, I said to him, my dear good, my sweet life, tell me a little bit. Why do you no longer tell me anything? You've never been used to hiding your secrets from me. Oh, please let us speak together a little, for in this way we will pour out a little bit of sorrow and love that oppresses us. So I want to give you Galatians 6:17 for Louisa sharing the crown of thorns with Jesus. Jesus said, my daughter, you are the relief for my pains. However, know that I do not tell you anything because you always force me not to chastise people. She has to know why this silence happens and why he doesn't tell her anything. You want to oppose justice. And if I do not do what you want, you remain disappointed and I feel more pain in not keeping you content, because he loves her. Therefore, in order to avoid displeasures on both parts, I keep silent. Now, she should know at this stage that the silence is usually to do with chastisement. Louisa said, "My good Jesus, have you perhaps forgotten that you yourself suffer after you have made use of your justice? It is seeing you suffer in the creatures themselves, because the divine will is present in every person and in everything. The divine will is omnipresent." So if creatures on earth suffer chastisement, then the divine will in them also suffers. "It is seeing you suffer in the creatures themselves that makes me more than ever alert in forcing you not to chastise the people." And then seeing them themselves turning against you like many poisonous vipers, such that they would almost take your life if it was in their power, because they see themselves under your scourges. So Louisa has a double problem here, that many human beings will not turn to God under the scourge. They will turn to cursing him and rejecting him. She said, because they reject you, because they see themselves under your scourges and they irritate your justice even more, I don't have the heart to say, fiat voluntas tua, your will be done. So in the next long section, Jesus begins to tell her what the problem is, and he tells her the state of the church, and it's not funny. He said, "My justice can take no more. I feel wounded by everyone, by priests, by devout people, we would say religious people and laity who are committed to the Lord, and by secular," that means people outside the church, "especially because of the abuse of the sacraments. Some do not care about them at all," adding despises. In other words, they despise them. "Others who attend them turn them into a conversation for their own pleasure. And others, not satisfied in their whims, because of this, reach the point of offending me. Oh, how tortured my heart is in seeing the sacraments reduced to painted pictures." In other words, no reality behind them. "Or like those statues of stone that seem to be alive and operating from afar." You mean ventriloquists? Something dead and a voice comes through it. Oh dear, what's the condition of the priest if he's called a ventriloquist? "They're like those statues of stone that seem to be alive and operating from afar. But as one draws near them, one begins to discover the deceit. For that, I want to give you Psalm 115. The idols have eyes and they do not see. They have ears and they do not hear. They have lips and they do not speak, and so on and so on. They have hands and they do not work. And yet what the pagan priests of old learned was that if they could manage to get a voice speaking through the idol, that they could deceive the people into thinking that the idol was real. There's a story at the end of the book of Daniel exposing all of this deception. Then when one goes touching these statues of stone, what does he find? Paper, stone, wood, inanimate objects. And here is how they are disillusioned completely. This is how the sacraments have been reduced for the most part. There is nothing but mere appearance. That, to me, is very frightening. 2 Timothy 3:5. Matthew 15:19-20. What to say then about those who remain more filthy than clean? In other words, they live immoral lives. And then the spirit of financial interest that reigns among the religious. Oh dear, Matthew 15:8-9. It's something to be wept over. Now, Louisa lives in Italy, and at this time, and it went on into the early part of the 20th century, families who owned lands or had big businesses would put a son into the priesthood And when he was ordained, then they would put him in charge of running their lands or running their businesses, which of course destroyed the man's vocation, if he had one in the beginning, because he got involved in all kinds of worldly affairs. So that's what Jesus is saying. And then the spirit of financial interest that reigns among the religious. Now, some men in religious communities were also involved. It's something to be wept over, he said. Don't you think that they are all eyes when there's a most wretched penny? Oh dear. Jesus told us you cannot serve God and money. It's not actually possible. And yet the terrible thing that Satan does with people consecrated to God is that he tries to draw them into money and power. And of course, you don't get money and power by themselves. Money, sex and power is what is used to bring down the human race. And the church has been attacked viciously in all three ways. So Matthew 15, verses 13 and 14. So they're all eyes when there's the most wretched penny to be got, to the point of degrading their dignity. But where there is no interest, that means you can't actually benefit. They've no hands, no feet, not a tiny bit. The spirit of interest fills their interior so much, we would say making money fills them so much, that it overflows outside, to the point that the secular people, that means the people outside the church, feel the stench of it and are scandalized by it. And this causes them to give no credence to their words. Now, the word secular seems to include the laity, because the laity are living in the world, and also the people in society who may not be in the church. Okay, and they're scandalized when they see the priests who are worldly and involved in business and so on, and getting pulled down by these terrible temptations. And therefore, when the priest then goes to teach, nobody listens to him because they know the way the priest is living. Ah, yes, no one spares me, he says. There are some who offend me directly and some who, though they could prevent so much evil, don't even bother. Now, that's one of the problems that we're still dealing with today in the church. And that is, if the bishops and the cardinals don't actually deal with the problems that have been presented to them, even our secular society today holds them accountable. So I do not know to whom to turn, Jesus said. But I will chastise them in such a way as to render them incapable, and some I will destroy altogether. Oh dear. So that would be Revelation 11:18. I will destroy the destroyers of the earth. Okay. They will reach such a point that churches will remain deserted with no one to administer the sacraments. Now, that has already happened in Russia in the first half of the 20th century, and the churches didn't recover until the very end of the century. So, interrupting his message, all frightened, Louisa said, Lord, what are you saying? If there are some who abuse the sacraments, there are also many good daughters who receive them with due dispositions and who would suffer very much if they couldn't attend them. He said, too scarce is their number. You see, he's seeing the whole thing globally and she can see it only from her little point of view. And therefore, our vision is myopic because we don't see the full platform. And he says that their number is far too few. And then their pain for not being able to receive them will work as reparation for me. And will also make them victims for those who abuse them. Louisa said, who can say how tormented I was left with these words of blessed Jesus, but I hope that he will placate himself in his infinite mercy. So October the 3rd, 1899, Louisa deals with Lady Obedience again. And then we've another message about priests. This morning, Jesus continued to make himself seen afflicted. I didn't have the courage to say even one word to my most patient Jesus for fear that he might resume his plaintive speech about the state of the religious. In other words, she couldn't take any more. This because obedience wants me to write everything. Now, the priest has cottoned on to the fact that Louisa doesn't write everything she hears. And so he's beginning to give her an obedience to write, but Jesus has also told her. Now, even though this is so, Louisa has such a repugnance to writing that she will still be struggling with this in volume 6 and 7. Obedience wants me to write everything, and also that which regards charity towards one's neighbour. That was the bit she was hoping obedience would forget. And this is so painful for me that I had to fight by the force of my arms with Lady Obedience, more so since she changed her appearance into that of a most powerful warrior armed with his weapons to give me death. In truth, I found myself in such constraints that I myself do not know what to do. To write about charity towards one's neighbour, according to the light that Jesus made me see, seems impossible to me. That's why the priest wants it so badly. I felt my heart being wounded by 1,000 prickings. I felt my mouth being struck dumb and my courage failing me. And I said to Obedience, "Dear Obedience, you know how much I love you and that for love of you I would gladly give my life, but I see that I am not able to do this. I can't do it. You yourself can see the torture of my soul." Here you need to remember that Louisa has no education, not even primary school education. So she's being asked to write something of extremely high mystical theology for someone who has no education. So it is an extraordinary challenge for her. "Oh, please," she said, "do not make yourself an enemy. Don't be so ruthless with me. Be more indulgent with one who loves you so much. Oh, please, you yourself, come to me and let us discuss together what is the most appropriate thing for me to do or to say." So it seemed that she laid down her fury and she herself dictated what was most necessary, enclosing in a few words the whole sense of the difference, the different things that regarded charity. In other words, the priest gave her a couple of headings and that and said, "Look, why can't you deal with it from this particular angle?" and so on. At times, however, Obedience wanted me to be more detailed. And I would say to her, it's enough that they understand the meaning with a little bit of reflection. So Louisa thinks everybody else is contemplating at the depth that she is. "Isn't it better to enclose all the meaning in one word instead of many words?" Louisa said. At times Obedience would surrender, others I would, and so it seems that we got along. How much patience it takes with this blessed Lady Obedience. Do you remember she has already told us, I think it was in volume 1, how much patience she had to have dealing with Jesus. She doesn't yet realise that in dealing with Jesus, she's dealing with Obedience and vice versa. How much patience it takes with this blessed Lady Obedience, truly a lady, for it is enough to give her the right to Lord, and that changing her appearance into the most meek lamb, she herself makes the sacrifice of toiling and allows the soul to rest in her Lord, placing herself around her with vigilant eye so that no one may dare to molest her and to interrupt her sleep. And while the soul sleeps, this is Psalm 127, what does this noble lady do? She drips sweat from her forehead, hastening the toil that belonged to the soul, something that truly causes every human mind, the most intelligent, to be stupefied and shakes every heart to love her. So, now, while I'm saying this in my interior, I kept saying, but what is this obedience? What is it made of? What is the nourishment that sustains it? And Jesus made his harmonious voice heard externally in my hearing. He said, "Do you want to know what obedience is? Obedience is the quintessence of love. Obedience is the finest, the purest, the most perfect love. And it is extracted from the most painful sacrifice. To destroy oneself in order to live again from God, out of God. Being most noble and divine, obedience tolerates nothing human in the soul and nothing which does not belong to it. So this is real obedience demands death to self. Therefore, all its attention is on destroying within the soul everything which does not belong to the divine nobility. That is, it must destroy the love of self. This is why the obedience demanded of Louisa was total, because total death to self was required. Unfortunately, today, in the church and in society, obedience is not understood. It's not appreciated. It's not loved. It's not carried out. And once obedience has done this, that is, killed off love of self, it cares very little about whether it alone struggles and toils on behalf of the soul while allowing the soul to rest peacefully. Finally, I myself am obedience. Wow. Louisa was up against Jesus all the time, absolutely demanding that she would be like him in every possible way, every dot and every comma. This will be quite a shock for her. So now Jesus has told us since volume one, I am faith, I am hope, I am love, I am truth, I am the life, I am obedience. Watch this gathering momentum as we go along. That's why in the Divine Will prayers, we call him the All. He's everything. Oh, who can say how amazed and ecstatic I remained on hearing these words of Blessed Jesus. Oh, holy obedience, how incomprehensible you are. I prostrate myself at your feet and I adore you. Romans 9:11. And I pray you to be my guide, teacher and light along the disastrous path of life. Deuteronomy 32:15. So that guided, instructed and escorted by your most holy light with certainty, I may take possession of the eternal harbour. Now the problem is solved. If Jesus himself is obedience, then it means that all she's got to do is throw herself on him. If he wants something, you can't do it. He can do it. And that's why in the Divine Will, you hear it being said all the time that Jesus says, if you desire it, I'll do it. We only have to throw ourselves upon him and throw our nothingness into his allness. That's all. So Louisa says, I stop here, almost forcing myself to go out of this virtue of obedience. Otherwise, I would never stop speaking. So much is the light of this virtue that I see that I could endlessly continue writing about it, because she's writing about the Lord. But other things call me, and therefore I keep silent and I go back to where I left. So I saw my sweet Jesus afflicted, and remembering that obedience had told me to pray for a certain person, with all my heart I commended him to the Lord. And Jesus told me, my daughter, may he make all his works shine with virtue alone. She's praying for a priest, you see. And so all his works should shine with virtue alone. But especially, I recommend that he do not meddle in the things of family interest. Uh-oh. If he has something material, let him give it away. That's Luke chapter 6 and Luke chapter 12. He does not want priests involved in secular stuff. I don't want him to get involved with anything else. God is jealous. And if you give yourself to him, he wants the whole of you. This priest should let things be done by those who are supposed to do them. In other words, let the secular deal with the secular. Or as Jesus said to a young man who wanted to be a disciple, he said, let the dead bury the dead. Let the secular deal with the secular. You come into the kingdom of God. So he does not want priests involved in either commerce or politics. And while he should remain disentangled, free, without getting muddy with earthly things, otherwise he would encounter the misfortune of the others who, since they wanted to meddle in some things in their family business from the beginning, all the weight then fell upon their shoulders. And I, only because of my mercy, had to permit that they would not prosper, but rather become poorer, so as to let them touch with their own hands how unseemly it is for a minister of mine to sully himself with earthly things. So Jesus said here that other priests who got involved, he had to step in and let them fail so that the family would let them go and he would be able to be a priest. On the other hand, this is a word that came from my mouth. The ministers of my sanctuary, as long as they do not touch earthly things at all, would never lack their daily bread. That was the promise made to all priests in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 18:2. And the rule was that the church was to support the pastors. The pastors were to feed the people spiritually and the people would support them in their material needs. That's the reason why we give donations on a Sunday. Now, with these ones, if I had allowed them only to prosper, the ones who get involved, he said, they would have sullied their hearts and they would have cared neither about God nor about the things pertaining to their ministry. And then, bothered and tired of their state, they would want to shake it off, but they cannot because priesthood leaves a permanent mark. And this is the penalty for what they shouldn't do. But so many priests in our lifetime, thousands of them have walked away and they've gone away to other things, but the mark of the priesthood will be there even on the day of judgment. And then we'll see how sad it was for them. Priesthood is a permanent state. You cannot leave it. Louisa says, after this, I commended a sick person to Jesus, and he showed him his wounds, which that sick person had given to him. In other words, that there's justice in the sickness. I tried to pray Jesus to placate him, to repair him, and it seemed that those wounds would heal. And Jesus, all kindness, said to me, my daughter, today you have performed for me the office of a most skillful doctor, for you have tried not only to medicate and to bandage the wounds that the sick person gave to me, in other words, healing involves reparation, but also to heal them. So I feel very much soothed and placated. Then Louisa said, I understood that by praying for the sick, one comes to perform the office of doctor for our Lord, who suffers in these very images. In other words, Jesus suffers in each one of us. So the image is Genesis 1:27 and Romans 8:29. So, October the 7th, 1899. Jesus is indignant with the people. This morning, blessed Jesus was not coming, and I had to have very much patience in waiting for him. In my interior, I kept saying, my dear Jesus, come, don't make me wait so much. I haven't seen you since last night, and now it's getting late and you're still not coming. She finds his absence completely intolerable. See how much patience I've had in waiting for you. Oh, please do not let it be that I reach the point of losing patience because of your long delay in coming, because then you would be the cause of it with your delays. Therefore, come, for I can take no more. Now, while I was saying this and other nonsense, my Jesus came, but to my highest sorrow, I saw him almost indignant with the people. Immediately I said to him, my good Jesus, I pray you to make peace with the world. And he said, daughter, I cannot. I am like a king who wants to enter into a house, but that house is full of filthy things. It's full of rot and of many other dirty things. The king as king, has the power to enter, and there's no one who could prevent him from entering. And he could even clean the house with his own hands, but he doesn't want to do it, because it's not decent for this his royal person to descend to such baseness. And until that house is cleaned by someone else, in spite of the fact that he has the power, the will, and the great desire to do it, to the point of suffering for it, he will never deign to set foot in that place. Hebrews 12:14, nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. If you go to the book of Revelation as well, in chapters 21 and 22, where you get a description of the New Jerusalem on the earth, you're told that everything unworthy is outside of the city. Jesus said, that's what I'm like. I am a king who can and wants, but I want their will. I want them to remove the rot of sins. In other words, we have to repent. And it's perfectly clear in the Gospels that Jesus was most kind to even public sinners once they repented. Nowadays, people think that God should agree with their sins, and they think that's mercy. I want them to remove the rot of their sins. So you need to read Isaiah chapter 40. Before I enter and make peace with them. No, it's not decent for my royalty to enter and make peace with them. On the contrary, I will do nothing but send chastisements. The fire of tribulation will inundate them everywhere, to the point of knocking them down, so that they may remember that God actually exists. Because that's the problem with many sinners today, that they have long since forgotten that God exists. And God is the only one who can help them and free them. So Louisa, interrupting Jesus, said to him, Lord, if you want to lay hand on chastisements, I want to come. I no longer want to be on the earth. How will my heart be able to resist in seeing your creatures suffer? Now, what Louisa doesn't realize is that Jesus is speaking to her prophetically. And I want to give you Amos 3:7, that the Lord never does anything without telling the prophets first. And so some of the messages that Louisa was given happened in her own lifetime. Some happened afterwards, and I think some still have to happen. And Jesus, assuming a kind appearance, said to me, Louisa said, if you come, where shall I dwell upon the earth? Matthew 5:8, he can only dwell in the pure in heart. For now, let us think about being together down here, that is on the earth. For we will have plenty of time in heaven. We will have the whole of eternity. And it's more important to work together down here. Now, that's 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 to 10. You may want to go and be with God, but it's actually more important to stay on the earth. Okay. So, and then you too, have you forgotten your office of acting as my mother upon the earth? She has forgotten it, you see. So while I chastise the people, I will come and take refuge in you and dwell in you. 1 Corinthians 3:16. Louisa said, Ah, Lord, what is the purpose of my state of victim for so many years? What good has come to the people while you said you wanted me as a victim soul to spare the people? Now, she just doesn't realise the platform on which the Lord is speaking. She's looking at it in a way that's far too myopic and small. And now you show how these chastisements, instead of happening many years ago, are happening later. You see, she's beginning to realise that some things are happening now, some things happen later. Nothing more and nothing less than this. And he said, my daughter, don't say that. I have been forbearing for love of you. And the good that came from this has been that while terrible chastisements were to rage for a long time, they will in fact be shorter. So she's having a much greater effect than she knows. Is this not a good? that instead of being under the weight of chastisement for many years, one remains only for a few. If you take the two world wars, 1914 to 1918, and the Second World War, 39 to 45, instead of it going on and on and on, in the past we had a 37-year war. Or 30 years, I think it was. Moreover, during the course of these past years, with wars and sudden deaths, they should not have had the time to convert, but they did, and they were saved. So that's Ezekiel 18, verses 21 to 23 and 30 to 32. God doesn't want the death of the sinner. He wants them to convert and live. Is that not a great good? Jesus said. My beloved, for now, it's necessary to make you understand the purpose of your state for yourself as well as for the peoples. And I will show it to you when you come to heaven. And on the day of judgment, I will show it to all nations. Therefore, do not speak like this anymore. He's had enough of this. We're going to stop there right now.